Case on calendar this morning, 70151 Castillo versus United Federal Credit Union. If counsel for the appellant is ready to proceed, please do so. Do you wish to reserve any time?
5 minutes, Your
Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Cole.
Your Honor, my name is Robert Murphy. I represent Lucila Castillo and this lawsuit. The underlying lawsuit involved a claim for class-wide relief on Article 9, specifically alleged that the credit union failed to comply with the notice requirements with respect to post-repossession notices of sale to class members. The issue before the court is whether or not the district court had jurisdiction to consider this class claim. There are three components of the court's consideration. One is whether or not the individual claimant, Ms. Castillo, met the jurisdictional requirements for district court. Two, whether or not the claim for injunctive relief presented by Ms. Castillo gave the district court exclusive jurisdiction. And three, whether or not the district court can aggregate absent class members' claims to satisfy the jurisdictional requirements for district court. So we have kind of a micro issue and a macro issue. The micro issue is the claims of the individual plaintiff. The macro issue is whether or not the court can aggregate class members' claims. The first issue, we filed a lawsuit on behalf of Ms. Castillo and the class of people similarly situated, and we sought in the lawsuit B2 and B3 relief under Rule 23. The B2 relief is prospective relief, injunctive relief against the credit union with respect to collection of deficiencies and the reporting of deficiencies on the class members' credit reports. That was in the lawsuit we filed. The injunctive relief is both common law and also under Article 9. 9.625 of Article 9 provides for statutory injunctive relief as part of the civil remedies section of Article 9, Part 6. We met the district court's jurisdiction just on behalf of her alone. With respect to the aggregation of class claims,
So even if we credit that your injunctive relief claims were fairly pleaded and legitimate, then we don't reach the aggregation issue.
That's correct. And yeah, we believe that the Edwards case is dispositive of this issue. In Edwards, the court had a lawsuit under the TCPA where the plaintiff sought statutory damages under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, as well as injunctive relief under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. And in that case, it was a statutory injunctive relief claim. And this court held that because the person, the plaintiff was an individual lawsuit, had asserted injunctive relief in the initial complaint, the district court had jurisdiction.
Let's say he just sued in his own name and we didn't have any class allegations. What would the injunction look like that he's asking for?
With respect to Ms. Castillo in this case.
Yeah.
Ms. Castillo would seek injunction.
For herself, I don't know.
Herself would be an injunction, a direction from the district court to the credit union not to report any adverse credit information on her credit report into the future. In the brief filed by the credit union, they stated that, well, we're going to comply with the law. I think it was a beta law analysis that they advanced. In all due respect to the credit union, that's not adequate to protect Ms. Castillo under common law and also Article 9. She had a right to restrain them from collecting on the account, and she had a right to, among other things, to protect her credit in the future. She was going to suffer damage if the credit union decided, hey, we're not going to report now, but in 3 years we may report, and that could very well happen. What recourse would Ms. Castillo have with this court, with respect to her legal rights if they go ahead and report in the future? And this type of lawsuit where a plaintiff is challenging the wrongful practices of the credit union with respect to compliance with very clear statute, Article 9 is very clear what they're required to do when they repossess people's individuals' cars. In a consumer transaction, they're required to send the notice of sale. And every single one of the class members in this case had the right to seek relief under, we sought B2 under Rule 23, injunctive relief into the future. And in the reply brief that we filed, I cited a case called Whitaker versus Navy Federal Credit, which was a B2 class in the District of Maryland, where the only relief for the class members was injunctive relief into the future that prohibited the credit union, Navy Federal Credit, from trying to collect on the defaulted accounts for the class members and from reporting adverse credit information on the class members' credit reports. And that was the only relief given to the class in that case from 2010 District of Maryland. And I presented that in the reply brief to basically drive home the point that a lot of these class actions that are filed are only about injunctive relief for a lot of for a large part of the cases. In this case, we're also having a B3 claim where we're seeking to get money for the class members. In the argument that was advanced by the credit union in their brief and with the district court below, was that Rule 23, the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, has somehow created a rule law that you cannot aggregate individual class members' claims to get into district court. That was their argument. If the court would review the appellate brief filed by the credit union, specifically on page 10 of the brief, and they quoted from Inlay Ford Motor Credit Company versus Citibank, Inlay Ford Motor Company, Citibank, a Ninth Circuit case. The Ninth Circuit stated, the doctrine that separate and distinct claims could be aggregated was never and is not now based upon categories of old Rule 23 or any rule of civil procedure. What the Ninth Circuit was stating was that...
In this case, I don't really have an issue because we have a proposed class. There's been no motion put forth for the approval of the class. And we had two parties originally named. One died without a successor being appointed. So we only have one party who's valid when this was before the district court.
That's correct.
How should we look at it?
I'm sorry, Judge?
I said, how should we look at it? I understand what you're saying. But does that really apply under the circumstances as this case wound through our district court?
This is the point that I think what the court is saying is that, is this a mootness issue? We did not have an opportunity to prepare nor advance a motion for class certification. In order to do that, we'd have to have some minimal discovery with respect to numerosity, commonality, and typicality.
Did you raise that in your response to the motion to dismiss?
No, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Rick, I understand correctly. What you're saying is you got shot down right out of the chute, so you never got to the Rule 23.
That would be an excellent characterization.
Okay.
Judge, I can go look at the record when I sit down, and I'll tell you what we tried to do to advance the discovery in the case. But
well, we're not being asked today, I assume, in this appeal to analyze Rule 23. It's more an issue of do you have subject matter jurisdiction. Rule 23 as far as the numerosity, typicality, all the other ones we usually see in like construction defect cases here.
Which, and reading through the recent decisions of the court, and that would be what the court typically looks at. In this case, the issue is we had a jurisdictional issue to begin with.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm trying to sort this out. I know that we came up here on a motion to dismiss, but if we agree that the injunction request was properly pled and requested, is the aggregation issue moot at that stage? Because you would have, the district court would have jurisdiction under the injunction, whether we agree you can aggregate or not.
I think the court can, as I mentioned, micro issue. The micro issue is that there was injunctive relief pled, and so we don't have to get to the issue with respect to aggregation, which is the macro issue. I use the expression because it's a constitutional issue with respect to aggregation. The law is very clear that the district court has exclusive jurisdiction for injunctive cases or injunctive claims.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
On aggregation. Well, I have one preliminary question. The district court's order mentions, it says, the court finds a review of the record does not reflect an order certifying a class action may be maintained. That caught my eye because I'm like, is he saying even without a motion for class certification, he's rejecting that this could be certified as a class, or is he saying because there's no jurisdiction, we're not going to let you go forward? What do you understand that sentence?
Justice Bickering, I have struggled with that comment first time I saw it. I don't know what that means.
Okay.
I think what he meant was that the case hadn't been certified, So he was going to treat
it. But it would be very unusual to file a motion for class cert on the, at this stage of the proceeding.
It would be unusual at the current time, yes, ma'am.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
You know, it's, and this was not an issue where there was an argument of mootness at the start, which comes into an offer, judgment, something like that.
So you don't know what
I do not know what the lower court meant by that.
Okay, I have another bigger question, and that is on this class aggregation, and I looked at the split of authority, and it looked kind of evenly divided in other states. I understand that Zahn is federal, and federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, and whether we would apply Zahn is up to us. But we have the Nevada Justice Court Rules of Civil Procedure that allow, they have a Rule 23 for class proceedings in justice court. And my quick look, it looked like the states that are saying, we're going to allow aggregation of claims under our state laws rather and depart from the federal jurisdictional analysis because otherwise these claims will never get redressed and justice court is not up to the task of doing that. I didn't see that those courts, those jurisdictions had justice court rules that allowed class actions. But I wasn't able to run that out. I didn't have time to do all of it. Do you understand my question?
I understand the question exactly. And this was an argument that was presented by the credit union in their brief. It appeared, for at least, like say, Michigan, there was not a mechanism into their lower court rules to allow for a Rule 23 motion of class certification.
How important is that, I guess?
I don't think it's important because, and I've got 3 minutes.
I'm sorry.
But I think it's important. May I answer that question on rebuttal? Because I think it's appropriate, because I need to listen to what...
Well, go ahead and answer the question.
Yes.
Answer it now, I'll give you 2 additional minutes, and you give counsel 2 additional minutes.
Well, here's...
It's an important issue.
Here's what the argument was, what the ruling of those courts were that said we don't have a comparable rule, is that the class members are going to have no recourse.
Right.
Well, we will not have recourse in this state either. Consider this. If we had simply taken the district court's opinion and said, okay, we're going to refile this case in justice court, there are a number of outcomes that will come out of that. The first outcome is, and I wrote it down, first outcome, certification of a class of persons having at each having damages of less than $10,000 only. Second outcome, certification of a class of persons having claims of more than $10,000 and less than $10,000. Third, transfer of action to district court upon certification if the aggregate claims exceed $10,000. And fourth, certification of class, but only to the aggregate of $10,000. So in this case, we're very close to $10,000 with just Ms. Bastille's claim. So theoretically,
you're saying there are the plaintiffs out there that may have individual claims of more than 10.
Right, so therefore, you would end up having a situation where, let's say, Ms. Castillo, and this is why is the credit union pushing this issue? It's basically to kill the class action completely. Because once we get to justice court,
You would be able to maintain a class action in justice court on behalf of plaintiffs whose claims individually were less than 10, assuming we don't aggregate.
That's correct. Or...
I mean, I'm not saying you would be able to, but that would be your
question. Let's say each class member with over 10,000 or now 15,000, what's going to happen to their claims? They're not part of the class.
They'd have to bring their own claim in.
Is that, you know, that could be. But what
that's
happens
a jurisdictional
with respect to tolling
limitation,
issues,
yeah.
with respect to pendency of the class action? Or worse, where do you appeal from justice court? It's a mandatory appeal of a class certification order. You can appeal it as a matter of right. So if I get a denial and they get a grant, we go to the district court, and that is the court of ultimate, that's the last court of appeal.
It's a good thing for us.
Perhaps. However, the case law will never develop. Rule 23 will remain Rule 23 forever. And so that, at many claims, and theoretically, this is the answer to the question, why do we have, why does the state have, not we, why does the state have a Rule 23 in justice court? Theoretically, you can have a case under 10,000.
Has there ever been a class action in Nevada Justice Court?
I couldn't find one, Your Honor, but I have not done an exhaustive review of everything.
Okay.
I have got 43 seconds left, Your Honor. Thank you.
Does that include 2 minutes? Or
no, I still give me 2 minutes and 36 seconds. I'm going to rebut.
Okay.
Honor. May it please the Court. James Cole today, appearing on behalf of United Federal Credit Union. With me today is Robert Hernquist. United is respectfully requesting that this honorable court affirm the trial court's dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint pursuant to Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 12b1 for the following reasons. First, the court should affirm the district court because it correctly refused to allow the plaintiffs to aggregate their claims with those of the proposed class members to satisfy the minimum jurisdictional requirement of the district court. In Nevada, courts measure standing by the amount in controversy. It is the plaintiff's duty and obligation to prove that there is an amount in controversy to invoke the jurisdiction of the district court. If they don't do that, then the district court correctly dismisses their case. This court has not ruled on whether or not a proposed class member is permitted to aggregate claims with the proposed class members under Rule 23.
Even if we just simplify this down to the single claim,
mm-hmm.
should we consider the deficiency plus what was named, potential deficiency?
I understand the question, and the answer is no, Your Honor, because the deficiency is not a claim that they can add together. Under the Uniform Commercial Code and under Nevada law, which teaches us that double recoveries are not permitted, you're not allowed to get two recoveries for the same injury. We cited to Your Honor the USEP versus O'Reilly case, and the comments in the UCC, section 925, specifically state that the UCC is not, it doesn't incorporate or doesn't advocate double recoveries.
Mr. Cole, I'm sure you're going to get there, but
yes.
On the injunction issue,
sure.
We can talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
My question is the aggregation issue irrelevant if they can get into district court and get jurisdiction for the injunction, then they can pursue ancillary issues because there's a virtual jurisdiction of district court and ask for an injunction. What's your position on that?
My reading of the case law is yes, if they have a legitimate or properly pled claim for an injunction, there would be jurisdiction with the district court. However, in this case, there is not a legitimate request for an injunction. If you look at the timing of this matter, the motion to dismiss was filed with the court. The arguments that were presented with the district court were we're allowed to aggregate, we're allowed to double dip and add our damages twice. There was no mention of this jurisdictional basis based on injunctive relief until the oral argument at the motion to dismiss. And then they finally filed a motion for reconsideration. And that's the first time they actually briefed it to the court. So this was not a significant consideration.
Did they file a motion for leave to file an amended complaint to assert an injunction?
They did not, Your Honor. No. So this was not a significant consideration for them. And
did they ask for injunctive relief?
The complaint itself does have wording that says they request injunctive relief. But again, under 12b1 and under the Emperor case, courts are to look at the properness of that request. And the request in this case...
Sure.
And then
but they did ask for injunctive relief in their pleading.
In the complaint, that the last line of, the second to last line, I believe, in the prayer for relief says that they would like injunctive relief. Yes.
So there's no affirmative allegation in the body of the complaint for injunctive relief. It's only in the prayer for relief.
I believe that there is, I want to say paragraph 30, and I could be wrong about that, but somewhere in the 30s they do mention that they would like some injunctive relief. But
since we're on a note, we're a notice of pleading state, not a code pleading state, would that be sufficient to put, in this case, your site on notice that they're requesting this relief?
Yes, under 12b6 analysis, that would be correct, but we're talking about 12b1, which is this a properly pled or is this an appropriate claim for an injunction?
Why don't you talk about that? We haven't got to there. Tell me why you don't think it's an appropriate claim for injunctive relief.
Well, first, when you look at what the comments of the district court were, they looked at it and stated basically, and this is the fact, that the request is for enforcement of a judgment that is going to be made at a future date. So what they're saying is we would like United, if we prevail, to obey the law at some future date. And available injunctions just aren't proper. That's not a proper claim for injunctive relief. And so They're asking for, you know, we don't know whether United has or hasn't done something wrong, or whether they're going to be adjudicated to have done or done something or not have done something wrong. So at this point in time, it's completely
vague. So Mr. Murphy's, I think his argument for injunctive relief was he wants a mandatory injunction ordering the credit union not to make any negative credit reports about his client, you know, like that. So you're saying that wasn't brought up in district court, you know, that type of relief?
It, that was, I don't believe it was specifically stated in the complaint, but I could be wrong about that. But
was it argued to the district court?
The argument in the district court was pretty vanilla, and it was towards the end of the argument, and there wasn't a whole lot in the oral argument of the district court. It was raised more significantly in the motion to reconsider, where they cited the Edwards case and their belated claim for injunctive relief. But as we mentioned before, it's still not a proper claim for an injunction.
Mr. Cole, let me ask you a practical problem. Let's say we agree with you. Mm-hmm. Affirm. I mean, this dismissal would be affirmed on the injunction issue. The dismissal, in essence, would have been without prejudice, wouldn't it, in district court, because it was a pleading issue. And couldn't they, if the statute of limitations isn't up, couldn't they refile it and a new complaint and allege all this, and we're back to square one? Or how do we deal with where this case is going to go from here?
Well, I think the appropriate place, which this court has clearly recognized by enacting the district court rules of civil procedure, is justice court rule of civil procedure. This is a small claim class action suit. We're talking about under $7,000 of damages by our calculation. That's what justice court's for. If they had filed a justice court in the beginning, this case would have been adjudicated by now. I mean, we're 2.5 years in, and they've gotten nowhere with their complaint.
I want to ask a question, though, and go back to your answer to Justice Gibbons. If they seek an injunction that says, please do not file adverse credit reports against me, and I want a court order forbidding you from doing so, why is that simply a follow-the-law injunction that should not be sufficiently a colorable claim for injunction relief?
That injunction presupposes that the reporting is wrong, and you couldn't.
Right, but it's a dispute, not the merits of it, right?
It's a dispute at this point in time, and so with respect to that request, until such time as United is adjudicated to have done something wrong, or they can show a substantial likelihood of merits, there is no basis for the injunction. At the end of the case, if United is wrong, it must not report these as wrong. We shouldn't report them as debts that are not paid properly. So that would be an obey the law.
What if the allegation were that they had reported it already to somebody and they wanted you to take corrective action?
But we're still dealing with the cart before the horse, which is the determination of whether or not that is rightful or wrongful.
And isn't that always in a lawsuit, like that you and I dispute who's right and who's wrong?
That's correct. That's absolutely right. And then at the end of the day, assuming it's not resolved through settlement, a fact finder says you're right or you're wrong, and then the effect of you're right or you're wrong then plays out. So in this case, if United is right, it is entitled to make reports to the credit reporting agencies. If United is wrong, it is not entitled to make reports to the credit agencies.
Okay, it's not really my area of law, but if you wanted them to not make any reports while this suit was adjudicated, would that not be a fair subject for an injunction, at least a temporary one?
That's not what was pled in this case. And you know, if they really wanted something like that, they certainly have the right to write the credit union directly under the Fair Debt and Credit Reporting Act, and that would be stopped, especially in a case like here where you have a lawsuit, you could present it to them. So
I don't want to hang you up on the injunction because there are broader issues that, from the questioning you...
Understood, Ron. And I think it's important to come back to the concept that there was no attempt to make that motion in the district court. They had over a year from the...
Right, there was no motion for preliminary injunction or...
No, temporary restraining order, nor was there a motion for preliminary injunction. It was not until oral argument on the motion to dismiss that this issue first was raised.
So you're saying it's kind of a Hail Mary issue?
Agreed. Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. It is a make-weight argument, and they're just I don't know why they don't want to go to justice court, but you know, we have rules.
They gave you an idea of what they see as the problems, that it would balkanize their claims. They would have more than 10 and less than 10 if we don't aggregate, which is awkward. They don't want to end with appellate review in the district court. And I forget the other point, but they have some unworkability issues about maintaining a class action in justice court.
But they are still going to have their day in court, assuming they go forward in justice court. They will have at least the right of an appeal, and the district courts are clearly wise and could rule one way or the other on whether class certification is proper or whether the trial is properly adjudicated.
Yeah, I might add too that there is another remedy. After district court, you can ask for a certiorari in the Nevada Supreme Court in any justice court matter after it goes to district court.
You're not supposed to give the secrets away.
We've seen them before, then, so like that. Mr. Cole, I guess I understand your position completely. My big concern is the procedural posture. The court granted a motion to dismiss. See, if this was a motion for summary judgment, I'd feel a little bit more comfortable. A motion to dismiss is just based on the pleadings here than like that. So a lot of the arguments you made sounds like kind of like a summary judgment issue, that there's no genuine issue of material fact. And so tell me what your response is to that.
Understood, Your Honor. It's the same issue that came up in Edwards, where the court talked about the 12B6 standard of review, which is every item is supposed to be accepted as true, etc. We're under 12B1, where the court is making its own, the trial court had made its own independent investigation of the matters that were submitted to the court, the papers that were provided to the court, the arguments that were made to the court, and determined that the claim injunction was not properly pled. Under Edwards, if you have an improper, fraudulent, or a claim to satisfy jurisdiction of the district court, it's not to be accepted by the courts. And this, Judge Sattler correctly, in our opinion, looked at what was presented to him and determined that this is not a proper request for injunctive relief.
Are there any state court cases that hold aggregation is appropriate, even though they're equivalent to our justice courts, have class action rules?
I believe there was one, Your Honor. If I could just look at my notes, I'd yes. have to pick that one out for you. But I want to say, yes, Arizona did that. Arizona, the decision in Judson School was that their courts are courts of, when they say their courts, they were talking about Zahn and they were talking about Snyder, and they were saying federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, and so they rejected those cases and said, we're just going to allow the plaintiffs to file in the equivalent of our
And they're just, they could have brought those claims in the Arizona equivalent of a justice court
yes.
as a class.
Yes, okay. But Judson School is wrong, and we discussed right. that in our brief. You know, our courts are, in fact, courts of limited jurisdiction. The way our Constitution lays it out and the way the Nevada legislature has set the jurisdictional limits of the Justice Court. If you don't get to district court, the Justice Court would have original jurisdiction. Today it's up to $15,000, and when we thought it was $10,000.
Yeah.
So it's a much better or a much closer fit to the federal system, where you have to have diversity and specified damages. So Judson, I don't think it's...
So you would just apply Zahn to Nevada and be done with it?
I would, but I mean, Zahn is decided by the United States Supreme Court, and I consider that to be a pretty good body about interpreting the rules of civil procedure.
Well, but that was interpreting 1332.
Correct, but then Snyder was decided behind Zahn, and Snyder was with the new amendment to Rule 23, and Snyder specifically looked at, are we going to allow aggregation under Rule 23? And Snyder said, look, no, the concept of amounting controversy or scanning is based on the individual's claim. You don't get to aggregate, notwithstanding the changes to Rule 23. I'm out of time, but if you have further questions, I'd be more than happy to discuss anything with you.
I don't. You've satisfied me.
Nothing additional at this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Please the court. In the amended complaint, which was the topic of the motion to dismiss, we alleged in paragraphs 27 through 37 the basis for injunctive relief against the credit union. And we went through great detail the reasons why what they were doing, post-repossession, prospective credit reporting, and collection activities. Those were the factual allegations. And in paragraph 53 of the first amended complaint, we discussed the basis of our claim for relief under Rule 23b-2, which is prospective relief for the class, based on the fact that the credit union acted generally with respect to class, with respect to collection, credit reporting activity, as described above, making appropriate equitable relief with respect to class as a whole.
In paragraphs 27 through 37, since I don't have the complaint in front of me, did you allege that they had in fact done an act of reporting, or only that they could report?
Paragraph 31, I believe, Your Honor, is the paragraph where we made that representation that they wrongfully collected and or reported correction information to the credit reporting agencies. And again, this was the amended complaint, and we're this state is a notice pleading state. Our initial complaint.
I understand that, but I'm looking for something. It's kind of like, as a court, and you have to understand it. The two of you are, we have to make a decision. We like to be perceived as being right. Yes, so we're looking for something to hang our head on.
That is the thing that comes to have goes on.
Okay, tell me this. What exactly are you asking for by way of injunction? Tell me, just spell it out to me in plain English. What relief are you requesting?
The injunction would be an injunction into the future prohibiting the defendant credit union from attempting to collect on deficiencies and reporting on the deficiencies to the credit reporting agencies. This isn't a beta law injunction. The class members will not have relief if they're reporting on the credit reports. Counsel referenced the Fair Credit Reporting Act. I'm intimate with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The remedies of the Fair Credit Reporting Act are not the same as a judge saying you violated an injunction, given credit reporting on this account that which you're not entitled to collect money on.
May I ask one more question? Yes. There's a doctrine that if you file a complaint and you include a prayer for injunctive relief, but you don't file a motion for temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction, and it's something that should have been done, that your laches is going to kind of defeat that claim. And here I think they're not making that argument, but they're saying this case was pending for a year before anybody, you never sought an injunction other than in your pleading. That gives me a bit of pause whether or not really the injunction was only a permanent injunction that would be sought at the end of the case, and whether they're right, that it would just be a law, thou shalt obey the law injunction, which of course we can't deal with.
I understand your point, Your Honor. Theoretically, we could have made that application with temporary injunction. However, I don't think it would have been, our position was it wouldn't be well received to begin with, because the court would say, I didn't have jurisdiction to enter the injunction. I don't have a way to answer that question the way that it doesn't fit within my practice model of how I do these cases. And maybe it's my own fault as an attorney.
No, I'm just curious. I'm not casting fault on anyone.
Your Honor, I understand what you said. I have filed motions to protect the class before in terms of trying to protect the class from having class members picked off, having things to disrupt the class action practice. So this is a mootness issue, an offer of judgment, whatever. What the credit union is trying to do here, they said, well, they should go to the justice court and get their case. And this case has been over. It very well may have been over. It may have very well ended as an individual lawsuit, because the mechanisms and the scenarios I gave the court of four or five different scenarios, it's the class action Pandora box when you go to justice court. I'm basically saying that.
Yeah, the tolling would be very different. You'd have to sort that out.
And I, of course, don't practice in this day. I'm honored to be allowed to appear before you to address these issues and support issues for people in the state. But I understand that the justice courts are the most overworked courts. They've got more cases, and granted, small cases, that's what they're supposed to be for. But what they would have is have potentially classes of a million people, all with claims of $25, $50, people being cheated, let's say, by Uber, not picking on Uber, at the airport, with respect to airport fees. Those claims would be in justice court according to their view. And we believe that the proper and the progressive view is to have an aggregation of claims, to have it in the district court where the district court will make the decisions. Thank you, Your Honor. Any questions?
Anything additional?
Thank you.
No, thank you. We thank counsel for casting additional information out for us to look at in terms of this important matter as well as the oral argument. So we thank you for the arguments made this day. We are appreciative. This matter.